Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So for those of you who just come in, the sutta this afternoon is the 53rd sutta, the Seka Sutta. I don't know if we have, is there any more copies left? Or are they all gone now? Is there anyone wants some more copies of the sutta on the table? I don't know how many more there are there, but maybe. Good. For those who've got the book, it's book number 5, it's the 53rd sutta, Disciple in Higher Training. So this particular sutta, it's the word Seka is an interesting word. In the path towards enlightenment, once a person gets that first understanding of what Buddhism is all about, in other words, they become a stream winner, then they, of course, from that time on, the learner. In other words, you've seen what needs to be done, now you start training yourself accordingly until you eventually become an arahat. Or in one of the similes, which is one of my favorite ones from another sutta, just like the shipwrecked sailor who is floating on top of the water in a lot of difficulty. Then he turns around and he sees where the shore is. And once you see where the shore is, once you know what to do, then the sailor starts swimming to the shore. And that's the simile which the Buddha gave of someone who sees the Dhamma, sees the problem, and starts practicing accordingly. This particular teaching is taking the practice from having seen the Dhamma and then how you're going to practice from now on. And what's the most interesting part of this sutta, it gives you the simile which I've said before of the three insights as the three breakings out of the chick from the egg, which is one of the nice similes of the Buddha. So let's, as we go through this, and I'll be pausing to explain a few points in more detail. Here we go, 53rd Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Seka Sutta, the Disciple in Higher Training. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country at Kapilavatthu in Nigrodha's Park. So that's his hometown. Now on that occasion, a new assembly hall had recently been built for the Sakyans of Kapilavatthu, and it had not yet been inhabited by any recluse or Brahmin or human being at all. The assembly hall was called a sabha, and that was where the community would meet, and they would discuss matters of concern for the community. It was literally their parliament, and even today the parliament of India is called the sabha. They're using the same word as in the ancient times of Buddhism. And this was because the Kapilavatthu was a republic. In other words, it ran on a democratic system. And this was the place where they would meet to discuss whatever needed to be discussed and decide democratically on what should be done. And it was because the Buddha's hometown was a republic, and another place where the Buddha used to live in Vaisali was the Wajjian Republic, that the Buddha used the democratic model for the legal system governing his monastery. So even today, the Buddhist monks and the Buddhist nuns follow a democratic system, not a top-down hierarchy, as was done in the time of the Buddha. And the assembly hall here, the new assembly hall, was the place where they would meet to discuss the governance of their community. So it had just been built, hadn't been inhabited yet. And after paying homage, then the Sakyans of Kapilavatthu went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, they sat down on one side and said to him, "Venerable Sir, a new assembly hall has recently been built here for the Sakyans of Kapilavatthu, and it has not yet been inhabited by any recluse or Brahmin or human being at all. Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One be the first to use it. When the Blessed One has used it first, then the sachems of Kapalavata will use it afterwards. That will lead to their welfare and happiness for a long time. And as it says in the note, but it's not just a Sri Lankan custom, it is a common custom in many of the old Buddhist lands, even in Thailand, when you built a house, to invite the monks there, or the nuns, either to sort of stay there for the first night, or if not that, I've done that a couple of times, if not that, at least invite them there for an almsgiving, which is what we do very often here when you move to a new house. So they invited the Buddha to the assembly hall for the first time, just to, as you might call, consecrate it. The Blessed One consented in silence. And that is another typical way in ancient India. When you ask a question of anything, or you ask for any favor, often people would consent in silence. However, please don't use that method here. If you want to ask for anything, please get the permission of the monks and nuns, because otherwise they may not really hear what you're saying, because they're speaking to someone else, and you take their acknowledgement of, they take their silence as a yes. In that time, silence meant, yes, we agree. So the Blessed One consented in silence. Then when they saw that he had consented, they got up from their seats, and after paying homage to him, keeping him on their right, they went to the assembly hall. And then they covered it completely with coverings and prepared seats, and they put out a large water jug and hung up an oil lamp. Then they went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, they stood at one side and said, "Venerable Sir, the assembly hall has been covered completely with coverings and seats and have been prepared. A large water jug has been put out and oil lamps hung up. Now is the time for the Blessed One to do as he thinks fit." And that was also the diplomatic way for talking to a monk. You don't say, "Now you can come," or "No, come on, get ready, off we go." You say, "Venerable Sir, now is the time for the Venerable to do as he thinks fit." Or if you go and see Sister Wayama, one of the nuns, "Sister Sari, now is the time for you to do as you think fit." In other words, get in the car, come on. You can try that for your husband as well. Dear husband, now is the time for you to do what you think fit. Come on. Then the Blessed One, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, he went with a sangha of bhikkhus to the assembly hall. When he arrived, he washed his feet and then entered the hall and sat down by the central pillar facing the east. And the monks washed their feet and then entered the hall and sat down by the western wall facing the east. So the Buddha in the center, the monks behind him facing east, with the Blessed One before them. Now, because of that was, again, another standard description of where the Buddha would sit, in a central pillar facing east. Because of that, in many countries, they always try and put the Buddha statue in a position facing east. And if you have a look at our Buddha statue, it's not facing that direction at all. It's facing west. And indeed, the story was that when we first built our monastery down in Serpentine, and we built the hall, it just was obvious that we put the Buddha statue where it now is. And so, after we built the hall, there was a group of Thai people came, and they were very upset, saying, "Your Buddha statue is facing the wrong direction, this must be bad luck," because it was facing west again. And of course, one of the monks, one of the chief disciples of Ajahn Chah, happened to be there at the time. And when they complained to him, he said, "These Western monks, they don't know what they're doing. They put the Buddha statue and it's facing west. It should be facing east." And being a good forest monk, he said, "Look, don't worry about that. If the Buddha wasn't happy, he'd turn around by himself." And that was a very nice rejoinder. But anyway, that's where that custom comes from. In many places here, you always see the Buddha facing east when he goes in the hall. And the sakyans of Kapalavata washed their feet and entered the hall and sat down by the eastern wall facing the west. In other words, facing the Sangha, with the Blessed One before them. Then when the Blessed One had instructed, urged, roused and encouraged the sakyans of Kapalavata with the talk and the Dhamma for much of the night, he said to the Venerable Ananda, "Ananda, speak to the Sakyans of Kapalavata about the disciple in higher training who has entered upon the way. My back is uncomfortable. I will rest it." And this was obviously meaning it was a time in the later career of the Buddha, because in many suttas the Buddha did have back pain, and he would often just rest in this particular way, especially late in the night. And it was attributed to the harsh austerities he did as a young man. You know, for 6 years, from his 29th to the 35th year, and a period after he left home before he became enlightened, he was doing many, many austerities, living a very harsh life. And they always say in the commentaries that the asceticism over those years meant in his later years he had some physical problems, especially the backache. So all of those with a bad back, you know you're in good company. Even the Buddha had a bad back. And those were the days without physiotherapy and goodness knows what else. And it's also a case you have to be very careful, because what you do in your younger years, you pay for in your elder years. So Ananda said, "Yes, Venerable Sir," the Venerable Ananda replied. Then the Blessed One prepared his patchwork cloak, folded in four, lay down on his right side in the lion's pose with one foot overlooking the other, mindful and fully aware, after noting in his mind the time for rising. So he took a nap. So the outer robe, the second robe which you sometimes see us wearing on the over our shoulder, folding it in floors like a little mattress, with his head propped up by his hand, and then that's how he used to go to sleep. So then the Venerable Ananda addressed Mahanama the Sakyan, who's one of the senior members of the community at Kapalavati, the lay members. And he addressed Mahanama. Mahanama, he was already, I should mention here, Mahanama was already a stream winner. And because he was a stream winner already, he was already a disciple in that training, from the stream winner to the full arahat. So that's why he was addressing Mahanama and telling him about what should be done to take yourself from being a stream winner to being a full arahat. So this is like the higher training. Mahanama. Here, a noble disciple means one who is a stream winner or above. He is possessed of virtue, guards the door of his sense faculty, is moderate in eating, devoted to wakefulness, possesses seven good qualities, who attains at will without trouble or difficulty the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind and provide a pleasant abiding here and now. So this is the training you're supposed to be doing. And now, having said it in brief, now he explains what it means. And how is a noble disciple possessed of virtue? What actually is virtue here? Here a noble disciple is virtuous. They dwell restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha. This is especially for the monastic community. The Patimokkha, the 311 rules for the bhikkhuni, or 227 rules for a monk, which make sure you don't do anything which is going to harm another being or harm yourself, and also the rules which keep you living very simply, so you can't amass many possessions if you keep your precepts. You have little things, like even if you have some sweets, you can only keep them about 7 days. So if I have chocolate, I have to eat that within 7 days or give it away. Usually it gets eaten within 7 days. But you can't keep it and amass stuff. So you dwell restrained with the strength of Patimokkha. You're perfect in conduct and resort. Your conduct is just the general, the way you hold yourself, the way you speak. And the perfect in resort was a very interesting observation by the Buddha. Sometimes, like being virtuous, it's not just how you act and how you speak, but sometimes where you go. Because even if you are a very good person, but you go to places where suspicion might arise, then that's a danger for you. So even if you may be a very, very good monk or a wonderful nun, but you go to the pub, then people might doubt your virtue. What are you going to a pub for, you know, as a monk or a nun? I often tell the story, the one time I went to a pub. I think I told that a few days ago, didn't I? When was the last sutta class? It came up again. Okay, but anyway, just in brief, if you weren't there. Rotary Club in Pinjara, they were holding it in a back room of a pub, and I thought there was a back entrance. There was no back entrance. The only way into the pub was the front door, and the only way to the room was past the bar. So I was dropped off by the driver, and then the driver had gone, so I couldn't go back home. I was stuck there. So I had a choice. What should you do? You're invited to give a talk, you know, on Buddhism. It's a good group, the Rotary Club. But the only way to the place giving the talk was past the bar. So what do? Head down and make a run for it. So I made a run for it. Unfortunately, as I bent past the bar, one of the Rotarians noticed it was me. I don't know how they noticed it was me, but they grabbed me on the arm and said, "Come over here, have a drink." So I said, very quickly, no. I'll go into the room. I'll have an orange juice in there. But again, the thing is, that what happened if somebody's seen me? If they had a camera, and here's Ajahn Brahm in the par of the hotel in Pinjara. You know, how would you explain that? You know, so I'm going to a Rotary Club. Oh yeah, we know. So that's why as a monk, it's not just a case of being a good monk. You've got to make sure you don't go to places where they call, you know, it's places where people might doubt what you're supposed to be doing. So you don't go say Northbridge during the middle of the night or something, because these are places where monks aren't supposed to be. So your resort, the place where you go, is also restricted. Perfect contact resort, seeing fear in the slightest thought, what I said last time, means you don't sort of become paranoid, but you see the danger. Instead of fear, the word is danger in the slightest thought. So if you do make a mistake, you see there's consequences to this, so you've got to be very careful. And therefore you train by undertaking the training precepts. This is how the noble disciple is possessed of virtue. Please interrupt me if there's anything to say. And how does the noble disciple guard the doors of the sense faculties? Again, as 2 weeks ago, on seeing a form with the eye, a noble disciple does not grasp as its signs and features. Since he left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. So you practice a way of his restraint. You guard the eye faculty, undertake the restraint of the eye faculty. For example, if you're a monk, and sometimes it happens that, you know, you may be on an aircraft and people are serving dinner, and there you are sitting in your seat and you look at what your person sitting next to is eating, and you think, oh, that looks really nice. They don't give food like that to me at the monastery. And then if you leave your eye faculty unguarded, you soon get very, very hungry. So little things like that, that, you know, sometimes people stir themselves up by not being careful. So another thing, if you see something in the shop, you know, a beautiful dress which you really, really like, you think, oh, that would be very nice, that would be very nice, that would be very nice. But you haven't got enough money left on your credit card, or, you know, you'll never fit inside of it. Then, you know, you should stop looking. So, because that way, if you left your eye unguarded, it just makes you feel bad. So this is why we actually guard our senses. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, that's... Yeah, he's saying you're seeing like as if you're a blind person. I know they have the three monkeys, you know, see no evil, hear no evil. What's the other one? Speak no evil. I remember once when somebody mentioned that to Ajahn Chah, and he said, that's being stupid. There was... one of Ajahn Chah's stories, when he was like a young, nothing a novice, maybe 18 or 19 years of age, like a young boy, you know, full of hormones, and he decided, but very, very strong-willed, he decided for the 3 months of the rainy season retreat, he would not look at any girl. So his, you know, his eyes were always down, and he would not look at any girl. For 3 months he managed, he said, to achieve that resolution. He thought that way he could lessen his lust. But after the 3 months determination was finished, the first girl he looked at just blew him away. And he realized that that was not actually how it works. Just trying to stop seeing nothing or hearing nothing, that's really not sort of how you sort of overcome sort of the greed, the great cravings or the ill will. It's that not seeing doesn't work. It's actually seeing, but seeing wisely. Hearing, but hearing wisely. So it's not closing your eyes, but training your eyes. So say here, to be restrained, not to grasp as its signs and features. So you look, but you don't look at that part of that object which is the most attractive. Say the food. You don't think, oh, the smell, that looks nice. You think what it's going to do to your tummy afterwards. So you see the other features which lessen your greed. You don't just look at the beautiful car in the showroom. You look at the price tag on it as well. So, you know, you don't just grasp some part of it and leave out the negative parts of it. You see it wisely. So I think it's not seeing as a blind person, seeing as a wise person. Does that make sense? So on hearing a sound with the ear. And it's just the same that this is another bit of restraint which we always have to have, especially in married life. Because sometimes your partner will say things which are unpleasant. So you don't grasp at the details or the features and think, oh, why did he say that? She should say that. So if you grasp at sort of the sound and its features, then that gives you a lot of grief, as it say here, or craving or whatever. So you learn how to listen. You don't close your ears, you have to listen. But you listen in such a way, you don't grasp at the features. She's angry at me. Oh, no, he's really upset at me. Don't grasp at those sorts of inferences. Just grasp is just words, that's all. And it's the same that you undertake the restraint of the on hearing and smelling an odour with the nose, a flavour with the tongue, a tangible with the body, or cognizing a mind object with the mind. A noble disciple does not grasp at the signs and features, because if you left the mind faculty or any other faculties unguarded, say evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade you. In other words, by practicing this guarding of your six senses, it means, you know, you don't get too much desire, too much ill will. You don't get upset by things. Even like criticism, it's just sound, that's all. Don't grab on to sort of the negative implications of those words. You know, you can always say, well, at least the person's talking to me. Isn't that nice? Or, as when I was starting building, you know, I did much of the building in Bodhinyana Monastery, and of course, it wasn't actually just two bad bricks in the wall. If you look there, there's many other bad bricks I never talked about. But there's also other errors which you did. And whenever I sort of said, oh, look what a big mistake I've done, one of the other monks would tell me, he said, a blind man would be glad to see it. And I thought, what a wonderful saying that was. So the next time that you make a mistake, you know, in any building or when you're cleaning up or whatever, you wash the dishes and there's still a mark on it, you can always say, well, you know, a blind man will be glad to see it. So in other words, you just look at it in a positive way so you don't get upset over much about what you see. So that's how we practice the guarding of the doors of the sense faculties, to give us at least some equanimity so we're not invaded by covetousness, which is really desire, sensory desire and ill will. This is our training, so we have an even mind. Now, is any question about that? Very good. That's actually how monks practice. Now, if people say rotten things about me, I just try and be equanimous. If I see something I liked, for this morning, or for our lunch, we had some, I haven't had it for years and years, some like dried mango. We used to have it in Thailand. They get the mango, they squeeze out the juice, and they dry it, and they wrap it up, and it's like a nice little sweet. First time I've seen it for years, so I put one in my bowl, but the person who put it in the bowl for me said, oh, that's nice. So I gave it to one of the Thai men, so he could enjoy it. So I never got it. That's a nice thing to do. I love doing things like that. Because that means that, you know, you don't get overly attached to things. That's how you're supposed to be practicing as a monk. The things you really like, give it to somebody else. And there we go. And how is a noble disciple moderate in eating? Here, reflecting wisely, a noble disciple takes food neither for amusement, not for intoxication, not for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuation of this body, for any discomfort and for assisting the holy life, considering I shall terminate old feelings without arising new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless, and shall live in comfort. That is how a noble disciple is moderate in eating. In some monasteries, and actually when I pause before eating, this is what I say to myself. This is almost like a saying grace, Buddhist style, before you eat. Instead of like thanking God for the food, here we actually just remind ourselves of the purpose for the food. It's not for amusement, you know, just for fun. We don't take it for intoxication like people take alcohol, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuation of this body. It literally is just used as a fuel for ending the discomfort of hunger or weakness, and for assisting in the holy life, considering I shall terminate all feelings of hunger without arousing new feelings of being stuffed. And that way I should be healthy and blameless and should live in comfort. So even in the time of the Buddha, moderation in eating was considered one of the trainings. And how is a noble disciple devoted to wakefulness? Again, last time, here during the day while walking back and forth and sitting, a noble disciple purifies their mind of obstructive states, especially of sloth and torpor. And I've mentioned before in the teachings on meditation how you overcome sloth and torpor. There's two types of sloth and torpor. The one which really is tiredness, because you have been thinking too much, working too hard, and you're basically tired. In such a case, the best thing to do is just to endure it, make peace with it, because when you fight, you're using up all of your energy, and you've got very little energy anyway. You can't waste any by fighting. You just stay there, be mindful, allow it to be, and your energy comes back. There's another type of sloth and torpor which comes from just boredom, because you're just not interested in things. In that particular case, you put more value into what you're doing. You're seeing the purpose and the benefits of, say, meditating or practicing the Dhamma. And after a while, when you see it's really valuable, it's really important, all the boredom disappears and you really get into it. So, and it's interesting here also, it says that here during the day while walking back and forth and sitting, one of the first references here to the two types of meditation, the walking meditation, you know, walking back and forth, this is what one does in a walking meditation, or in sitting meditation. You purify your mind of these obstructive states. And in the first watch of the night, when walking back and forth and sitting, you purify your mind of obstructive states. In the middle watch of the night, you lie down on the right side in the lion's pose with one foot overlapping the other, just as the Buddha did, mindful and fully aware, after noting in the mind the time for rising. So in other words, before the time of alarm clocks, you just make a determination, this is the time I'm going to rise, and it's amazing just how effective that is. And after rising, in the third watch of the night, while walking back and forth and sitting, you purify your mind of obstructive states. That is how a noble disciple is devoted to wakefulness. And how does a noble disciple possess seven good qualities? And this is a new one. Those other ones I was talking about last week. How does a noble disciple possess seven good qualities? Here a noble disciple has faith. Now obviously faith is a very dangerous quality, because you can have faith in all sorts of things, all sorts of cults. So faith is a dangerous quality, but it's also part of any religious path. So a noble disciple has faith. He places his faith in the Tathagata's enlightenment, thus, that this Buddha is accomplished. He is fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime knower of the worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and human, enlightened, and blessed or holy. So it's really saying that the Buddha actually was enlightened, which is actually takes a leap of faith, because this Buddha, we have some idea of who he was, we have some idea of his teachings, but all this stuff which he taught, was it really true? And obviously that faith which comes, first of all, it sounds good, it sounds inspiring, it's reasonable, it's logical, it's according to our experience. That gives you the first arising of faith, but that's not good enough. Then you have to start testing it out, practicing a little bit to see if it works. And if you see it does work, then that increases your faith. So it's a faith in, especially in the Blessed One's enlightenment. He is actually fully enlightened. And he is perfect in true knowledge and conduct. And I love those statements. So it's not just your wisdom, in the conduct. Because if a person is perfect in wisdom, then they are also perfect in conduct. The two go together. And sometimes it's hard to actually to know a person's wisdom when you don't know wisdom yourself. So one of the best ways of checking a person out is checking their conduct. So here, an enlightened person is perfect in wisdom and conduct. Wisdom, we may not sure what wisdom is, and what's true, what's not true, because we're still training, we're still finding out, discovering it for ourselves. But at least we know what's good conduct. So an enlightened person shouldn't be amassing lots of things. They shouldn't be getting angry. They shouldn't be exploiting people, or shouldn't sort of do things which obviously in the world are not what we'd expect even of an ordinary person, let alone an enlightened person. So check people's conduct, because the Buddha is perfect in knowledge and conduct. The knower of the worlds, as I mentioned last time, the three worlds, do you remember what the three worlds are? What's the first world? Yeah, Karmaloka, not Dhammaloka. Dhammaloka is this place. Karmaloka is the world of the five senses, includes the human realm, the world of animals, heavenly beings, ghosts, hell realms, animals, that's the world of the five senses. And beyond that, there's two other worlds. And that's the world of the jhanas, that's the mind-made world, and lastly, the perception-made world of the immaterial states. So this is what a person knows when they get into these deep meditations. Because these are not just states of mind, these are states where a person can get reborn into later on. And there's actually a mention of this at the end of this sutta. In other words, incomparable of persons to be tamed, and it would actually acknowledge there that some people are untamable. And not even the Buddha can tame everybody. So of all those people, men or women, who can be trained, the Buddha was one of the best trainers, one of the best coaches, but acknowledges that some people, even a Buddha, just can't train them. So if you've got kids who are untrainable, just please know that that's par for the course. But just be a parent who is the incomparable trainer of kids who can be trained. A teacher of gods and humans means he also, the Buddha, taught in the heavenly realms, enlightened, blessed. So that's the faith you have. You know, in the Buddha as a person, as an enlightened person, in his conduct and wisdom and knowledge. And that's the first of the seven good qualities. The second, you have shame. You have ashamed of misconduct in body, speech and mind, ashamed of engaging in evil and unwholesome deeds. So this is the aspect of conscience which everybody has. Oh, I wish I hadn't done that. That's not appropriate for a human being. It's not appropriate for a monk. Not appropriate for a nun. I shouldn't do such things. That degree of shame is important. As the next one, the fear of wrongdoing is afraid of misconduct in body, speech and mind, afraid of engaging in even unwholesome deeds, because you understand the karmic result of that. So in other words, you know if you do something wrong, that's going to hurt. If you said a bad word or done a bad deed, even if you don't get caught by your friends or your associates, at least you know that there's going to be a karmic response to that. So that's where you have this shame and fear of wrongdoing. The shame is a conscience feeling it's not proper for me to do that wrong thing. And also the fact that you know there's going to be a consequence to this which is going to be painful, going to hurt. Those two, the shame and the fear of wrongdoing, are usually called the guardians of the world. In other words, if those two are truly there, then a person has a great incentive to act with virtue. Now, unfortunately, whenever those two are absent in the world, in other words, people don't believe in the law of karma, so they've got no fear of wrongdoing. They think, no, I'm going to get away with this, it doesn't matter. If people don't see it, it's not going to matter to anybody. What's done behind closed doors, no one knows, so who cares? That sort of lack of fear of the karmic consequences of your action is one of the reasons why there is immorality in the world. And the other one is the lack of development of a conscience. Now, like being ashamed, now having an idea of a good person and wanting to be a good person. Anyone want to make any comments on those two? Okay. And that's what, two and three, four. You have learned much, and not only learned much, you remember what you have learned and consolidates what you have learned. Such teachings are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, and affirm a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Such teachings as these you have learned much of, remembered, recited verbally, investigated with the mind, and penetrated well by view. So this is one's education, if you like, one's knowledge of the Dhamma. This is actually what you're doing here. in this sutta class by learning what the Buddha taught, and by coming here fortnight after fortnight, you tend to remember what you've learned. You consolidate it by asking questions, and these teachings, which are good in the beginning, middle and the end, are the right meaning of phrasing, which affirm a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure, which leads to full enlightenment. So these you've learned, remembered, investigated with the mind, and penetrated well by view. So first you learn them, you hear them, then you really contemplate them until you really understand them. You've really penetrated them by view, not by experience yet. That's coming next. So study is an important part of Buddhism. This is one of the arguments I used to have with some of the forest tradition, when they just said, oh, just meditate, you don't need to read books. I said, no, some reading of books is very important, so at least you have some understanding of what the Buddha actually taught. And then meditate, find the balance there between your study and your practice. And next, number five, you are... Question, yeah, here. Penetrated by view, in other words... So more about penetrated by view. This is actually where the teachings of the Buddha, you've looked at these things, you've understood them, you get the framework, and your framework is pretty accurate. That's penetrated by view. Now you've got to actually try and experience them. Penetrated by experience. Understanding is a type of faith, yes, but it's the sort of thing where the sailor in the middle of the ocean has turned around and he can actually see the shore. So he can view the shore. Sorry? The stream winner, yeah. So you can see the shore, but you haven't stood on the shore yet. They are energetic in abandoning unwholesome states and undertaking wholesome states. You are steadfast, firm in striving, not remiss in developing wholesome states. So that is actually when you train your mind. If you get angry, instead of shouting your mouth out, you restrain yourself. Say no to that. You catch it very early. Because you can catch the anger very early before it really obsesses you, you can stop it pretty easily. Or you manage to arrange for strategies, such as if one particular person really sort of makes you boil. When they're not around, in the weekends, in the holidays, you spread loving kindness to those people. So you recondition your habitual responses to such a person. So there's all sorts of techniques, and most Friday nights you're teaching something about how to abandon the unwholesome states, and how you undertake wholesome states, such as forgiveness, such as kindness, such as not judging yourself and others too harshly. So you're energetic, you're not just listening to such practices, but actually abandoning the unwholesome states, just like anger, fear, greed, fault-finding. Abandon those and developing the positive states, what we call the wholesome states, now, such as metta, loving-kindness, equanimity, generosity, or some of these wonderful states like the joy in other people's success and happiness, and the compassion to the suffering of others. Developing in those wholesome states is we're energetic for that. That's also an important part of our path. And the next one is one of the interesting parts of this sutta. You have mindfulness. You possess the highest mindfulness and skill. You recall and recollect what was done long ago and spoken long ago. And here is one of those places where it gives another angle to mindfulness, which is not often mentioned in teachings of Buddhist meditation. Mindfulness is not just being aware of the moment. That's half of mindfulness. But it's also having a memory as well. What sometimes I say, you know what's going on, but you also remember what you're supposed to be doing, what the instructions are. Because if you're just mindful of the moment, but you're not really supposed to know what you're supposed to be doing when you're meditating, you can wander off in all sorts of places. And that's why sometimes, people have... I remember in the 70s, when I was a young monk, and people would come along and say, yeah, we're mindful too. Yeah, when I'm having sex with this person and sex with that person, I'm very mindful. So I must be practicing mindfulness. I'm going to become enlightened. They say, oh, come on. And they say, well, you're forgetting one thing, what you're supposed to be doing, being restrained, having a bit of virtue, for goodness sake. You're married. You can't go sleeping around with other people like that. I said, well, I'm mindful. Yeah, but mindful, you're not remembering what you're supposed to be doing. So mindfulness also has this other half to it, which is remembering the instructions, as I say. But also, that when you do practice that mindfulness, you do get a good memory. Simply because when you're mindful in this present moment, you're paying full attention to what's happening, all the information actually gets in. So once it's in, it can be recollected at a later time, especially for anyone who's studying. As I found out when I was studying, I went all the way to Cambridge with a good degree because one of the reasons was I was naturally gifted in mindfulness. I would pay attention to the teachers because I paid full attention. I could remember what was said. And I recall, even now, going to examinations, and when you got the question there in front of the paper, in front of you on the paper, not only did I know the answer, but I remember the time the teacher taught that in class. Now, I didn't have photographic memory. All it was, when the teacher was teaching, even in school, I was paying full attention. And because of that degree of mindfulness, it was easy to remember. And also, I remember my parents used to sort of be quite amazed because I didn't spend much time doing my homework and I always got lots of good marks. So it was great. They said, okay, well, I don't know how you do this. You don't spend much time doing your homework. You're getting good marks. Carry on. And all it was efficiency. So you kids, if you want to have a good time at school, get great grades but still have plenty of time to go to party, be very mindful when teacher's giving a lesson. You soak it all in, and your memory would improve enormously. That's really well known. So there is a very strong connection with mindfulness and with memory. And that's also one of the reasons why people who practice mindfulness, it hasn't been proven yet, but I'm sure it's true, people who practice mindfulness, meditation in other words, the chance of getting Alzheimer's is very, very low. I'd even say even impossible. If you practice mindfulness, you will beat the Alzheimer curse. So, keep coming here, otherwise you know where you're going to end up. And I know that because my poor mother's got Alzheimer's. So that's the sixth quality. You have mindfulness, possessed of the highest mindfulness and skill. You recall and recollect what was done long ago and spoken long ago. And lastly, number seven, you are wise, possessed of wisdom regarding the rise and disappearance that is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. That is how a noble disciple possesses seven good qualities. Who knows what the rise and disappearance is? What does that mean? It does not mean just the coming and going of phenomena. The fact that you can hear sound come and sound go. You can hear feelings arise in the body and then after a while they disappear again. That is actually not the real meaning of the arise and disappearance. The arise and disappearance in Buddhism doesn't just mean seeing things coming, but why they come. It is the cause of things. And the fact that when that cause is taken away, the things disappear. It's not just seeing the phenomena of rise and fall. It's seeing the why of rise and fall. And that's made very clear for anyone who wants to look in the Satipatthana Samyutta, in the arising, what's it, in the Samudaya Sutta, in the Satipatthana. It's why these things happen. And especially how you arose, where did you come from? And see, when that cause is taken away, you disappear. You got feelings of happiness. Where does happiness come from? And when that cause is taken away, then happiness disappears. It's not just the phenomena itself. It's understanding the causal connections between things. That's the rise and fall, which is meant, and that's made very clear in other suttas, by the wisdom regarding rise and disappearance that is noble and penetrative. Yes, Mike? It's a short way of saying Four Noble Truths, or dependent origination, or just basically causality. When there is this, this arises. with the ceasing of this, that ceases. That's the causality. And that's actually a basic theme in Buddhism. That's almost like its philosophical underpinning. To see the why, to see the causal processes which actually affect everything. Not just the outside world, but the inner world as well. And that underpinning, that cause and effect, which is a fundamental part of Buddhism, should also be applied in your meditation practice as well. It's not just knowing just peaceful states of meditation. But what causes the peaceful states of meditation? And that's why I've been hammering this for a long time. Put the causes into place. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Put the causes into place, and the effects come by themselves. Yes, Dania. Okay, that feeling of me and meanness. Exactly, I know that's what you're coming to. What's the cause of that state of meanness and I-ness? Now that's the interesting one. And all it is number one, a lack of data. So you're making that assumption just on a fragment of existence, which is not full. So number one, you haven't got all the information in yet, and you rush to this conclusion that I am. That's why even, was it Descartes said, I think therefore I am. What happens when you stop thinking? Which is what happens in meditation. When you literally are not thinking at all, when the mind is not moving, then where do you go? Now Descartes never did meditation. If he did, he'd have been confounded. Exactly, that's, you're just quoting the Buddha now. As Ananda once said, just all the feelings of me, the idea of I, is always depending upon one of the five khandhas, or a combination of them. It's either on a body, you identify the body as me, or feeling, perception, will, the sankharas, or consciousness. He said, just like a person, in those days they would look in a glass, polished glass, or in the water usually, to see a reflection of their face. So that the image which you see is just dependent upon then the mirror there. In the same way that the idea of I is dependent upon these five khandhas. The five khandhas reflect, and because of that you see a sense of I. You take away those five khandhas, investigate them, you see it's just a mirror, that's all. There's no I there at all. Exactly. The enlightened person doesn't have that sense of I or meanness. Very good. Yeah. Yeah. So what if you stop thinking? You're not. You stop. That's the thing. I think therefore I am. So when you stop thinking, I'm not there anymore. The thing is, but you can't think that, because if you think, then you become again. So you just know that. Okay, that's the wise. That is how a noble disciple possesses seven good qualities. So what they are again, they're the faith, the shame, fear of wrongdoing, learning, energy, or more like not energy, but like resolve in abandoning unwholesome things and arising good things, mindful and wise. And now, how is a noble disciple one who attains at will without trouble or difficulty? The four jhanas that constitute the higher mind provide a pleasant abiding here and now. This is the jhanas again. They always come up. The one thing I love about this one, where it says, you attain at will without trouble or difficulty. And that's how it should be. And that's why, how can it be without trouble or difficulty? Easy. Just let go and don't do anything. Because when you do things, that's when you have difficulty. And it's also, they constitute the higher mind. And this is, jhanas are just huge states. And so people say that these are just ordinary states. This is the higher mind, the adi-citta. And provide a pleasant abiding here and now. So actually this is the only real pleasant abiding you can have. So if you want a pleasant abiding, okay? Real pleasant abiding. You don't have to go on holiday to Bali. You don't have to sort of buy a great big house and have lots of furniture and even butlers and people serving you. That's not the pleasant abiding here and now. Pleasant abiding here and now is just getting into jhanas, having a great old time. So it doesn't cost you any money either. Here, quite secluded, not from sensual pleasures. We've been having a discussion with Ajahn Bhamari about this because it's on a paper he's writing. It's not sensual pleasures, it's a sensory world. And the sensory world here is karma. This is the five sense world. In Buddhism, the idea of sensuality or senses, in the West, that's called five senses. In the Buddha, they make five senses. The sixth sense is something completely different. They had a totally different word for it. So when it says the secluded from the five senses here, it doesn't mean secluded from the mind. This is when the five senses and with it the body disappear. Secluded from unwholesome states, that always means the hindrances, the five hindrances. A noble disciple enters upon and abides in the first jhana. And there's so many dot dot dots here because the reason why they have dot dot dots already, this book is, what is it, 1400 pages long. And just for the sake of brevity, they always abbreviate these jhanas because they come up so often. But just because they're abbreviated, you should always remember that these are so central to the teachings of the Buddha. With a stilling of applied and sustained movement of mind onto the object, not thinking here, thinking has gone a long time ago, you enter upon abiding in the second jhana. With a fading away as well of the rapture, that's half of what we take as happiness, you enter upon abiding in the third jhana. With the abandoning of all of this feeling of pleasure and pain with perfect equanimity, you enter upon abiding in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure. In other words, no happiness, no sadness, but pure equanimity, which itself is a different type of pleasure altogether. The ordinary pleasures is totally gone, but another much higher and sublime pleasure takes its place, the pleasure of peace, which and also has purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. And also I love saying that because many people think of these jhanas as trances. And they ask, what's the difference between a trance and these jhanas? And here you see it. It's the perfection of mindfulness. In a trance you have no mindfulness at all. You don't know what's happening while you're in a trance. You come out afterwards, you don't know what you said or where you've been or what happened. I remember just reading, if you want to read about people who had trances, perhaps the most believable, credible source or credible person was that fellow called Edgar Cayce. And he would go in these trances and he'd do amazing things. I remember once when he was in trance, he was like a Baptist, you know, one of these very, very devout Christians from the south of the United States. This was between the wars. And in a trance, someone asked him, what's the most important truth in the world? You know what he said? Under trance, this was maybe 1930 or something. What's the most important truth in the world? And this Edgar Cayce said, the law of karma. That's why I remember that. He said, wow, it's amazing. And when he came out afterwards and he said, oh, you just said the law of karma. I couldn't have said that. That's heresy. I'm a Christian. And he hadn't got a clue what he was saying in trance. But he said some really interesting things. But anyway, that's by the way. But in the trance, you don't know what you're doing. But in the jhanas, you are perfectly mindful. That's why it says, with purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. Because you're so still, the mindfulness is absolutely at its peak. That is how a noble disciple is one who attains at will, without trouble or difficulty, the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind, and prevent a pleasant abiding here and now. When it says at will, what it means is will. Okay, I'm going to stop now and have fun. Now, any questions on that? Right, very quiet today. Okay. When a noble disciple has thus become one who is possessed of virtue, who guards the door of the senses, who is moderate in eating, who is devoted to wakefulness, who possesses seven good qualities, who obtains at will without trouble and difficulty, the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind and provide a pleasant abiding here and now. They are called one in higher training who has entered upon the way. Their eggs are unspoiled, they are capable of breaking out, capable of enlightenment, capable of attaining the supreme security for bondage. So basically got all the causes now, right there, to become sort of totally enlightened. It's great actually, you can see here, having understood the Dhamma, this is actually the training. What you're supposed to do is the higher training. So let's just go through it again. You know, you have faith first of all, that's a given by this time. You know, your conduct, you have shame and fear of the karmic consequences of things. You understand enough about karma to do that. You've got the learning, you've got the energy, the mindfulness, the wisdom and the jhanas. You've got everything coming together. So in the higher training, these are the things which one should sort of focus on. Now if your faith is not, and you've still got doubts about the Buddha, then you know, better go back to square one. You should, you know, develop that sense of, you know, shame and fear of the karmic consequences. Get your learning. Make sure you study enough to know what the Buddha taught. You know, you have energy in abandoning unwholesome things and arising wholesome things. Your mindfulness is strong. You've got enough wisdom about the causes of things. And you've got those jhanas. Now you're ready. You've got everything together for the full enlightenment. And this is where the Buddha starts to introduce a simile coming next. Your eggs are unspoiled. If you some of these things are not quite there, your eggs are spoiled, they're not going to hatch. So here we go with the Buddha simile. Suppose there were a hen with 8 or 10 or 12 eggs, which he had covered, incubated and nurtured properly. And that refers to all these practices which you've just done. Even though she did not wish... This is interesting here. Even if she didn't think, oh, that my chicks might pierce their shells with the points of their claws and beaks and hatch out safely, yet their chicks are still capable of piercing their shells with the points of their claws and beaks and hatching out safely. Basically, it doesn't matter what the chicken thinks. Everything is there together. Those chicks are going to hatch. So even if you think, I'm going to, oh, may I become enlightened. Oh, may this happen. It becomes an automatic process. You don't think, oh, may I get the insight now, become enlightened. You don't have to think that. When all these causes are together, it happens. When the eggs are okay, and the chicken sits on it, they're going to hatch. Where the hen thinks he wants it and doesn't want it, it's just what happens. Okay, the chicks are capable of piercing their shells with the points of their claws and beaks and hatching out safely. So too, when a noble disciple has thus become one who is possessed of virtue, etc., he is called one in higher training who has entered upon the way. Their eggs are unspoiled, they are capable of breaking out, capable of enlightenment, capable of attaining supreme security bondage, whether you want to or not. So, having arrived at that supreme mindfulness, whose purity is due to equanimity, that's that fourth jhana, the disciple recollects their manifold past lives. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, you recollect your manifest past lives. That's only abbreviated there, again, because it's repeated many, many times. It means that in the past life, this is what you were called, this is where you lived, this is what happened to you. So it's not just having some sort of, maybe that was me in a past life. When you get these powerful jhanas, and you really have some strong mind states, then you can remember these things. And I've often said before, like, you're in those states, you can move around, ask the questions, get the answers, and you can find out who you were, what you did, and where you were, and what was happening. And it's not just one, many. That's what they call the aspects and particulars. You recollect your manifold past lives. This is the first breaking out, like that of the hen's chicks from their shells. This is where it simply gets interesting. That's when you just poke the first crack in the shell when you remember your past lives. And again, having arrived at that same supreme mindfulness whose purity is due to equanimity, with the divine eye which is purified as it passes human, this noble disciple sees beings passing away and reappearing, and they understand how beings pass on according to their karma. Karma means actions, so they're translated here as actions. It would have been better to put karma there. In other words, you understand, because of your recollection of past lives, how karma works, what drives a person from one life to another. So you understand the law of karma. And that is the second breaking out, like that of the hen's chicks from their shells. In other words, they've made a big hole now in the shell. And having arrived at that supreme mindfulness which purity is due to equanimity, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, the noble disciple here and now enters upon and abides in deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the outflowings. This is their third breaking out like that of the hen's chicks from their shells. They usually say there you understand the Four Noble Truths properly, truly, to the end. You become an arahat. And that's the third breaking out like that of the hen's chicks from their shells. Now they're totally free from their shells. And it's a nice simile, because imagine being in a little chick in a shell. Really it's just confined. But you know, that's all you know, so you think, oh, what a lovely shell I'm in. Isn't this fun, being a little chick in a shell? But then you break out and you see the big world outside. So this is what happens when you become free from samsara. You think, wow, this enlightenment is pretty cool. Just this chicken, totally free from this smaller leg of our narrow world. So that's a wonderful simile there about being contained, being confined, and you know, thinking it might be happiness, but it's really sort of unpleasant in a small little shell, and breaking out and being free. That's the enlightenment. It was Buddha's little simile of the eggs hatching. And again, even if you did not wish, may this not happen, it just happens. Yes, Dalia. And that is... Okay, now you're saying, is those three breaking outs really essential? I suppose like some chicks can just break out in one go. But that I think would be the rarity. So I think it would be far more common that people actually go through the standard way of breaking out, remembering past lives first of all, and understand the law of karma, which comes pretty easily after that, and then the Four Noble Truths. Correct. It makes it much easier when you remember your past life, you get the big picture. Because if you just see this one life, you may have a pretty good life. And actually, each one of your lives are not that bad. You know, you may have, you know, your suffering or your cancers and stuff, but you know, really, that's bearable. You have a lot of happiness and joy in the life. And all the lovely Friday nights you've been to, all the food fairs, all the little funny games we've all had in our life. So that's why a lot of times people look at this life and say, what's wrong with this life? But if you see it, it's not just this life, but other lives as well. Just this whole momentum of just going back and back and back and round and round and round of samsara. Like I said 2 weeks ago, that Groundhog Day. You know, that movie where the person gets reborn. At the night time he goes to sleep and he wakes up the previous morning. Keeps on repeating the day over and over and over again. Or like a movie I watched when I was a kid. It was a Dracula movie, but it was called The Thinking Man's Dracula, because this particular Dracula, he'd been around about 6 centuries already, and he knew that the only way he would die if he was lured outside when the sun shone. He'd only come out at night. The sun would kill him, and he was a very smart and powerful being, so he'd never actually go out in the sun. He'd always get home in his cave or something before dawn. But after about 6 centuries... he was just so bored. He had so much suffering for living another day. He just, the whole thrust of the movie at the end was he just allowed himself to be lured out. He had enough. Even in good health and happiness, after 6 centuries, you would like to have euthanasia. You'd had enough. That's why the whole idea of long life and long life and long life. After a while, even eternal life becomes one of the worst curses you could possibly have. It's interesting. See, that consciousness is dukkha. Basically, a lot of times we just can't see that well enough. Some people may be able to. Some very strong chicks can maybe sort of get out in one go. But most chicks, I mean the chicken chicks, not the girl chicks. Most chicks, they take a long time. They need a good 2 or 3 bashes with their beaks to get out. So this is the usual way. And as I often say, please don't take shortcuts. Everyone wants a shortcut, and that's why they waste so much time. So when a noble disciple is possessed of virtue, that is their conduct. When they guard the door of their sense faculties, that is their conduct. When they're moderate in eating, that is their conduct. When they're devoted to wakefulness, that is their conduct. When they possess 7 good qualities, that is their conduct. When they are one who attains at will, without trouble or difficulty, the 4 jhanas that constitute the higher mind provide a person abiding. That is their conduct. That's actually, in this one sense, what they do. That's the cause. And when they recollect their manifold past lives with their aspects and particulars, that is their knowledge. When they see the beings pass away and reappearing and understand how beings pass away according to their karma, that is their knowledge. When by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, they here and now enter upon abiding the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, are taintless with destruction of taints, that is their knowledge. And those are called the 3 knowledges. Vijja. It's called the Te Vijja, the 3 knowledges. You might even call them the 3 insights, the 3 big insights. So those are the conducts, in other words, how you, the causes, and these are the results. The 3 knowledges, or Vijja. And interesting, just for those people who don't know, the word Vijja has actually come into our English language as Witcher, the witchcraft. Exactly the same word. So, you know, a lot of times if people say, what are you doing in this Buddhist, we're practicing witchcraft. We're developing the 3 witches. I'm only just saying that, because it's not really what people understand as witchcraft, but that's actually where the word came from. Vijja and witcher is the usual English word for what is now known as witchcraft. All comes from the same place. Interesting. So I don't know exactly how that happened, but that's where it comes from. Do you have a question there? Oh yeah, sure. That would really give a lot of nibbida. Nibbida is a sense of, I've had enough with all of this. I've been here, done this. So many times I got married, got divorced, been a girl, been a boy, been in this realm, been in that realm, been rich, been poor. And after a while you've been there, done that, you've fed up with it and had enough. So that is a sense of you get dispassion. You want to leave. Just like that fellow in Groundhog Day, I want to find some way of getting out of this cycle of doing the same day over and over and over again. And as I said 2 weeks ago, his way out was falling in love. That was dumb. But of course, if you fall in love, that doesn't actually end samsara. You get reborn again. But this way is just learning how to let go. After a while that you've been many lives, you remember those lives, and some you've been incredibly spiritual, sometimes you've been really gross. But even in the spiritual lives, you realize that each one of these lives is like a prison. A different cell, a different sort of facility, but it's still a prison. And so in the end, you've had enough. You want to get out of the whole thing. This. Now this is the thing, when everything ceases, stops. No more rebirth. No more lives. Okay, the noble disciple, this is on page 465, almost finished. This noble disciple is thus said to be perfect in true knowledge, perfect in conduct, perfect in true knowledge and conduct. This is actually the word Vijacharana Sampanno, which we chant on a Friday night, on a Saturday morning and Sunday morning. This is perfect in knowledge and conduct, one of the attributes of the Buddha, but here shared by the noble disciples. And this stanza was uttered by the Brahma Sanan Kumara. Now, Brahma is one of the gods, and it does actually say in the back, in the notes, that this was a quote from another sutta, which is found in the Digha Nikaya, where this Brahma was somebody who in his previous life did practice the jhanas, and as a result of practicing the jhanas, he was reborn in the Brahma realm. He's obviously probably only did the first jhana in the Brahma realm. These beings, they go into the jhanas and they come out again, and then they can go and talk to people, and then they go back into the jhana realm. This is classical of those people in the Brahma realms, corresponding to many religions' idea of a god. And according to Sanan Kumara, means always young because he died young. And because he died young, his mind-made body was young, and that's actually how he always appears, this young Brahma god when he's not in the jhanas. And this stanza was uttered by the Brahma Sanan Kumara, and it was to the Buddha, and the Buddha repeated, or Ananda repeated this to the Sakyans, because the Sakyans were mostly of the Katiya clan. These are the warriors, not the noble clan, more the warrior clan. And he said, the warrior clan is held to be the best of people as to lineage, as to caste. But best of gods and humans is one perfect in true knowledge and conduct. So this was a very diplomatic thing to say, because this was a saying from a god, first of all political, saying the Katiyas, the warrior class or caste, is the highest caste. And of course, if you know the politics in the time of the Buddha, the four castes, the Brahmins, the Katiyas, or the here called the nobles, really the warriors, the merchants, and the Sudras, the lower caste, the workers, that was the caste system in the time of the Buddha. And at that particular time, the Brahmins and the Katiyas were vying for supremacy. And later on, as we all know, the Brahmins won out, they became the highest class, and the Katiyas were number two. And actually, nowadays, it's so many castes. The Buddha was actually trying to stop all of that business. But remember that this was actually said from a Brahma to a group who were the noble clan. So it's just actually basically buttering them up. Just like saw Kevin Rudd on Thursday, and he said, West Australia is a wonderful place, it's a beautiful place, and Perth is a wonderful city. Of course, you know, when he went to Queensland, I'm sure he'd say, no, Brisbane is a wonderful city, the best city. And when he goes to Darwin, he said, no, Darwin has just got this wonderful attitude. So this is just the politician being a politician. And says Brahma Sanan Kumara was also a bit of a politician here, telling these Sakyans of Kapilavata what they want to hear, that you're the best clan. But best of gods and humans is one perfect in true knowledge and conduct. Even saying a human being who has all of these amazing things is a perfect enlightened arahat. They're even better than the gods. Now that stanza was well sung by the Brahma Sanan Kumara, not ill sung, even though it was chanted, not really sung. It was well spoken, not ill spoken. It has a meaning, it's not meaningless, and it was approved by the Blessed One. And at the end of that, the Blessed One rose and addressed the Venerable Ananda. That's good, good, Ananda. It is good that you have spoken to the Sakyans of Kapilavata about the disciple in higher training who's entered upon the way. That is what the Venerable Ananda said. The teacher approved. The Sakyans of Kapilavata were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Ananda's words. So that was a sutta, a teaching of the path of higher training. And the ending was just a nice little sop to the Sakyans who were listening. But the first part of it was actually showing again another form of the gradual training, making a bit of an elaboration on the seven factors of faith, shame, fear of wrongdoing, learning, energy, mindfulness and wisdom, going a little bit more into the jhanas. And also about the simile of the hen's eggs, the chicks, breaking out with these three great insights, a way to become fully enlightened, which actually puts a little bit more emphasis on the importance of karma and rebirth as a fundamental part of the Buddha's teachings, to be realized as facts, as part of the breaking out from the shell and becoming fully free. So, any comments or questions about this sutta today? Okay. Mike got his hand up first. That's a very good question. It does seem at first glance that this teaching was addressed to the monastic community by the words of, you know, the jhanas and Patimokkha, but it was given to lay people. But remember, as you said, the first lay person in Mahanama, he certainly was a stream winner. Some people say he was a once returner. We're not quite sure. This was towards the end of the Buddha's life, as suggested by his bad back. So it would have been a time when these Sakyans had been practicing for many, many years. And obviously they were devoted Buddhists because the Buddha was, you know, basically their family. So they obviously had an inclination to listen to, you know, the teachings of, you know, one of their famous people of their clan. So they would have been practicing very well, and I'm sure that many of them would have been stream winners and once returners. And actually there's many who actually were. So that he was teaching them something which was very relevant to them. And it's a good question, because you point out there that in the time of the Buddha there were many lay people who were stream winners, once returners, and a few even were non-returners. Which is why, as a monk, I should never look down upon the lay community. You should teach to the highest level to everybody, because if it was possible then for people to be stream winners, once returners, and non-returners, why not now? There's one story, I was with him last night, told me he's got so many talks available on the internet, on his hard drive, saying that, look, we've got much more access to Dharma now than anyone ever had in the time of the Buddha. And he said, gee, if we can't become stream winners, once returners in this life, we've got all this access to all these teachings which were never there in the time of the Buddha, then surely we should be able to do something. In those time and now that people are full of paramis, it's, if you really want to actually to investigate that, there's two books you can read. Now, one is the Vinaya. Don't actually look at the rules. Get out the books that are in the library and look out the stories behind the rules. Because in those stories behind the rules, there you see all the scallywag monks and nuns who were getting up to mischief. And when you saw the sort of the things which they did in the time of the Buddha, you think it's exactly the same as people now. It's a very rare and wonderful historical document. Because usually people write about the heroes. You know, the ones, the whiz kids, the great people had all these psychic powers and great paramis. But in these books, because they're talking about monks who did bad things and a rule was made afterwards to stop monks doing that again, there you have some amazing stories. But a good example of that. Just what comes to mind. This young man, he just really wanted to become a monk. So he went back to his parents and said, I want to become a monk. Say, no way can you become a monk. We don't give our permission. So what he did, he said, right, if you don't give me permission, I'm going to lay on the floor and I'm going to die right here. So, okay, you die right there. They called his bluff. One day, 2 days, after 3 days, I think they brought his friends around. And his friends said, come on, don't be stupid. You know, you can make good karma and have a nice wife. You know, just stay around. He said, no. So for 7 days he lay down. And after 7 days, I think the mother and father gave in, because one of the friends said, look, if he's done 7 days already, he's so stubborn, if you don't let him become a monk, you know, he's going to die. But look, if you let him become a monk, you know, he's becoming a monk. After a few days, he'll disrobe. you know, you'll start to miss things. And then you've got your son, you've got a really good chance of him coming back to you. So his mum said, okay, let him go forth. Unfortunately, the friend gave bad advice, but he soon became enlightened, he never came back. Or another story about the Buddha's cousin, what's his name? No, not Devadatta, the one who's about to get married. Nanda, that's right, Nanda. The Buddha's cousin, Nanda. And so, the Buddha's cousin, Nanda, was about to get married. So like marriage ceremonies here, they invited the monks to offer some food. Make some merit so it's a happy marriage. So the Buddha happened to be in town, so the parents invited the Buddha to come and receive some alms food. So he received some alms food, and after receiving the alms food, he told his younger cousin, Nanda, here, you take my bowl back to the monastery. And his wife said, he can't, he's got to get married. He said, well, now he's my cousin, I've got to do this. So his wife spat on the floor and said, Nanda, you better come back before this dries up. That is what she did. So this is the type of people in those days. So is your wife here? Where's Ronnie? So that's what you actually say. If your husband goes out, spit on the floor and say, you better be back before this comes up. Before this dries up, or you'll be in big trouble. She's a really hard guy. But what did the Buddha do? As soon as he got back to the monastery, the Buddha ordained him as a monk. And he just had to, because in those days, the deference you had to the elders in your family was so great that he had to. But he thought, I won't stay that long. I'll just let the Buddha do what he wants to do, and then I'll go back to my wife. Because he had still lots of lust. So after a few days, he wanted to disrobe again. And the Buddha said, oh, just wait, come with me. And the Buddha used his psychic powers and took him to the Deva realm. And in the Deva realm, he had these really beautiful girls, these heavenly nymphs. And he said, look, who's more beautiful? Your betrothed who's waiting for you, or these beautiful heavenly nymphs? And Nanda, he was just being a sensualist. He said, well, actually, she's pretty ugly compared to these really gorgeous chicks up here. He said, well, look, this is all you need to do, said the Buddha. You just stay as a monk, and after you die, you can have as many of these as you want. He said, oh, that looks good. Yeah, okay, I'm into that. So when he came back from this heavenly excursion, he told his wife, I'll get lost, and I'm going to sort of wait until I get the heavenly nymphs. So he started practicing, staying as a monk, so he could get these heavenly nymphs when he dies. But of course, as he was practicing and practicing, he started getting insight and wisdom, and he became actually enlightened in the end. And even though his motivation for practicing was just to get some heavenly nymphs and get, super sex, he ended up sort of seeing through everything and becoming fully enlightened. He was just an ordinary bloke, just like you see in any pub on a Saturday night. So, these were ordinary people who get totally enlightened. So reading stories like that, and almost any character you have in today's world, you can actually see in those books. And it's wonderful actually to see that. Well, this other guy, Pindola, he just, he's met with great psychic powers. I'm just filling up because it's interesting stories. Great psychic powers. And he just actually beaten some big dragon in some major contest somewhere. But then they had these, in the same monastery, had these scallywag monks. They called them the Group of Six Monks. And the Group of Six Monks were just, Buddhism was getting very popular. And people asked him, well, what do you monks really like? Because, you get enough food and everything. So, something special for you. Sometimes people ask me that. Ajahn Brahm, what do you really want? Come with something special, something which you don't usually get. So when the Group of Six Monks heard this, they said, well, the thing we don't really get, which we'd really like, is some booze. That's what they said, some alcohol. And so the lay people said, okay, we'll give you some alcohol, because they were so interested in making merit. I'm sure if I told some of the Thai people or Sri Lankan people, I don't know, maybe they sort of know a bit too much these days, but sometimes they say, oh, this is what would be really good. It'd be really good karma for you, because you know what happens? What you give to a monk in this life, that's what you get in your next life. And so now a few people, they like their whiskey or whatever, so they think, oh, if I don't give a whiskey to a monk, I won't get some in my next life. There's all sorts of ways that monks can actually cheat like this. So anyway, there were these naughty monks in the time of the Buddha. So the next day, this monk got all this alcohol on arms round. And he thought, well, whatever you're given, you should just take. So he got totally drunk, and he passed out at the town gate. Now, unfortunately, just after he passed out, who was coming on arms round just behind him? The boss, the Buddha. And so he actually saw him, and because of that he made a rule. It wasn't a rule before. Monks are not allowed to drink alcohol. And that's how it came about, just because of some naughty monks. So it's interesting when you actually see this. But my favourite story, I usually tell this just on the retreats, is a story about, you know, auspiciousness and holy water. And that was a story in the nuns' monastery in Sawati. And in this nuns' monastery in Sawati, you know, those days you didn't have sewerage. So you just had your toilets and a bucket in the back. And you're supposed to take the bucket and put it in the compost pile or the pit somewhere. But early one morning, now this monastery was actually in the town, in a walled monastery inside the city. In the early morning, the nun who was supposed to be cleaning the toilet, she got the bucket, instead of putting it in a proper place, you know, it was really early in the morning, she threw it over the monastery wall. Unfortunately, on the other side of a wall, there was a man walking. And he wasn't just an ordinary man, he was this merchant who has had an appointment with the king. So when you're in an appointment with the king, actually even on Thursday, actually I had my robe washed on Wednesday just because of meeting Kevin Rudd. Even I go to at least wash your robe when you're going to go to see the Prime Minister. So imagine what this guy was doing before he saw the king. You know, he'd washed, he'd wearing his best clothes to go to the palace, and he got a bucket of shit on his head. Now imagine that happened to you. You know, would you be equanimous? He was really upset. He was really angry. He was incensed. So he got one of the torches, lit it, and he went into the monastery saying, I'm going to burn this monastery down. These are nuns. These are prostitutes. These are a bunch of whores here. Look what they've done to me. And he was so upset. But the monastery had a gatekeeper. And the gatekeeper was a very smart guy. He said, what happened? Why are you so angry? He said, look, I was going to the palace. I was well dressed and the nuns threw a bucket of shit on me. And this gatekeeper said, really? That's auspicious. That's lucky. Look, that came from holy nuns. And you've been blessed. You are just so, so fortunate. And this man said, really? Is that so? Said, yeah, it is. No, not everybody gets the holy water straight from the very heart of the nun. And they said, wow, you're so fortunate. He said, look, go back and get dressed. Something very wonderful is going to happen to you today. So this was obviously a guy with not much intelligence, but he believed the gatekeeper. He went home, he got dressed, and he bathed and got the smell away and put on some new clothes. And actually when he went to the palace, he got given this really lucrative contract from the king. So he went around saying, oh, it's very lucky to be blessed with the shit on top of your head from holy nuns. And of course, when he went around saying that, it soon got to the Buddha, and the Buddha got the nuns together and told him, he said, you were very, very lucky that time. And he made a rule. And the rule is there to this day, that nuns are not allowed to throw the shit over the monastery wall. And that's one of the 311 rules in the Patimokkha. So that I told those stories because it's true that monks, nuns these days, exactly the same as those days, they weren't special. And when you read all these stories, you know, down to earth, normal stories, they could happen today. You understand that people haven't changed that much. It's a window into real people in a society 25 centuries ago. It's a great area for sociologists to mine. The stories about the bad monks and the bad nuns, or the naughty ones, the ones that were stupid. And then you realize things haven't changed at all in all this time. That's why they could do it then, you can do it now. So, Hugh, did you ask your question? Okay, go on. Yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm. Indeed, yeah. It is a gradual training. This complements the sutra I said 2 weeks ago about the gradual training, giving a little bit more information about this gradual training, especially these seven factors as well. And after a while, when you read these sutras or you hear them again and again, so the picture emerges from this angle, from that angle, of what's actually necessary. Came again, yeah. The repetition, actually, with a few little different angles in it, eventually builds up the big picture. So, your last comment, yeah? Exactly. Your last words were most important. If it is done properly. Basically, the ingredients are exactly the same today as they were 25 centuries ago. It's whether you follow the recipe or not is important. Flour, sugar, honey, fruit, exactly the same as 25 centuries ago. But you must remember the recipe. Yeah. Well, these days, remember, most people would actually not wear any footwear when they're on the outside. Just like often in Thailand, we'd actually, you know, not have any footwear. Even after a while, even when I was walking around the roads, you know, you'd walk without footwear, your feet were very strong, and it was more comfortable. But these days, the people wear footwear. So usually, I remember in growing up, you'd take off your outside shoes at the front, you put your slippers on when you get in the house. Try to keep everything so you have your house shoes. And many other cultures have that as well. As a monk, or as you here, that you always take off your shoes when you come in here. We always assume that you wash your feet sometime this morning when you had a shower, so you don't need to wash them as you come in. But yeah, still do that in many places, in many monasteries. You always have foot baths there. Okay, so that's the sutta for today. So hopefully you enjoyed it, and a few little stories at the end to fill it out. And now we can actually pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha.